WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The recession is changing the expectations that many people are entering salary negotiations with. Salary Strategy is Everything You Need to Know to Get the Salary You Want is the title of a new book by my guest Marilyn Motes Kennedy. Kennedy is also the author of a number of other books, including Office Politics, Seizing Power, Wielding Clout, and Career Knockouts, How to Battle Back. She's the managing partner of an Illinois-based consulting firm called Career Strategies. She's also the career columnist for Glamour magazine. We're going to be opening up the phones a little later for any questions you have. Welcome to Fresh Air, Marilyn Kennedy.
Oh, thank you.
We'll be talking about a number of different office and work-related issues, but let's start with Salary Strategies, which is the subject of your new book. We've all been hearing a lot, and a lot of us have been experiencing, how the recession is affecting labor and unionized workers. Now, most office people are not unionized, including lower and middle level executives and managers. How is the recession affecting those kinds of corporate salaries now?
One of the interesting things about the recession is that it has created a climate of fear. And when I do seminars and when I make presentations, what I find is that so many of these people don't ask, how am I doing? They say, really, I would do better, but I'm afraid. I don't want to move. If I just sit here, maybe the world will pass me by. And even though none of them are in the auto industry and nobody's near Detroit, they think the recession is completely universal. It is not. There is a recession in the Fortune 500 companies, but businesses with under 200 employees are booming. They are making money hand over fist. But when do you read about them or hear about them in the media? The Wall Street Journal covers only the big companies. Fortune covers only the big companies, unless they pick out something like an Apple computer after it's grown big enough to be interesting. Out there in the world, little companies are really doing very well. This is a little company time.
What are some examples, without necessarily naming names, but what kinds of little companies are you talking about?
Any company that has a single idea, all the Johnny One Note companies, the little computer software companies, the little specialty grocery store that doesn't sell everything, the very, very nice restaurant that just does a limited menu for dinner. They're all making money.
Do you find that the recession is being used as a way for people to give lower salaries, you know,
It's a
bargaining
weapon in
tool,
the war.
Yeah, even for people who maybe aren't losing money.
And it's especially a weapon against women. Here's what happens. The boss calls you in and says, you have done a terrific job this year. Up front, you have really performed. You deserve a fantastic raise. Unfortunately, business is bad. Or, if it should be a nonprofit, they will say, we could give you a raise, but then there would be seven poor families we couldn't help. This is just an opening ploy. This is to see how determined you are to get more money or if you can be bought off in this way. It's like if I hit a ball to you across a tennis court, you should hit it back to me. But if I hit it really fast and maybe aim at your head, you may be momentarily off guard and you don't return it. A lot of employees will say, oh, okay, well, that means I'm not going to get anything. But they haven't even said anything or asked for anything. They're just there. So it's an intimidation tactic, and I see an awful lot of that in companies.
Well, when you're negotiating for a salary, whether it's because you're entering a job or negotiating for your annual salary increase, to what extent do you think it's incumbent upon you to find out what the true financial state of the business or corporation is, and to what extent do you think if they're losing money, you should internalize that and lower your expectations?
First of all, a company never loses money across the boards. Even Pan Am, which is losing money, or International Harvester has certain areas that are showing a greater return. The second thing is that the company's overall health is at issue here in a very different way. If the hard chargers and the high achievers leave, what will they have left, and how will they ever pull out of this? When you know you're in deep trouble, when you know that it is time to find the resume you tucked in behind the silverware 3 years ago, is when you can sense, because you look around and you can sense that everybody there has reservations for the word processing equipment because they can see the handwriting on the wall, that nothing can pull this company out of its slump. And yet, you know, one of the interesting things, Lee Iacocca of Chrysler has got a whole bunch of people who are working for him for a dollar a year. And instead of saying to them, someday our ship will come in, he's saying, do it now. Do it for the fun of it. Do it because it's interesting. It isn't only just money that moves people. But a lot of companies can neither sell what's good, nor can they convince the employees that they're not just ripping them off, because many of them are ripping them off.
What do you mean working for a dollar a year?
Lee Iacocca has persuaded a whole bunch of people at high levels in Chrysler to work for a dollar a year until Chrysler shows a profit, and then they will all get a regular salary. And he sold them on the idea that pulling Chrysler out is going to be the great historical feat, coup of the century. And he's working for a dollar a year. He won't take a nickel until they turn it around. So he's leading this team of people who are risk takers. Well, those of us who have mortgage payments and rent and all that, we probably can't buy that. But how many companies ever turn to the employees and say, here are all the other things we could do for you. Hey, we're flatlining it on a cash basis, but here's what I'll do. Let me give you an example of this, because there's really things companies can do for people. I got a secretary who's working like a potato bug. This lady deserves twice as much money as I can possibly give her. What can I do for her that's really helpful to her, as good as an untaxed bonus? What I'm going to do to keep her performing at this level, so I'm going to teach her how to do my job. I'm not going to sit there and say, if I teach her how to do my job, she may take my job. I'm going to say, you keep performing for me, and I'm going to show you how to, not knowledge about. I'm not going to tell you about how this company came to be, but I'm going to show you how you get from point A to point B. And if I can't get more money for you next year, you can turn this into my job in another company or my job here. I'm going to show you all the parts of it, what I really do. It's one of the ways we can hold on to people when we don't have money, but I don't see anybody doing it.
What's another example?
Well, for one thing, we might try a little recognition. Now, that seems really corny, but I don't know a soul that is even appreciated minutely, much less overappreciated. Have you ever been overappreciated in a job? I have always felt that I was working and nobody even knew. When things are going well, management is in a trance. When things are going badly, they're out there with the alligators. You never reach them a point where they say, hey, we know you're there and working, and we appreciate it regularly. Only when you save the company or you fall flat do you hear.
So recognition in terms of, say, a better title or?
A better title in terms of training. Training is recognition. In terms of putting into the grapevine in the company, look, we know that Mary Smith is doing a really super job, so that she hears it and her friends hear it and they carry back the tale. It swells her ego. People don't look for psychic rewards, and that's why they're so effective when companies think about it. And you'd think in a recession they would think about it. Wrong. Every company I'm talking about is still saying things like 3% is better than nothing at all. 3% might have a negative effect because it moves you to a higher tax bracket without giving you one nickel more you can see.
Say you're not getting the raise you think you deserve, and you want some of the recognition that you've described before. Is it appropriate to say, well, if you can't raise me to this level, then how about raising my job position?
It sure is, but I would ask for the money, and what I would do is I would say, look, I am not asking for a gift. I'm not asking because I deserve it. I'm not asking for any of those reasons, no justice. What I'm saying is, in the last year, I have reduced the time that it takes me to do a report from an hour and a half to 50 minutes. I know my way around this place. I can get things done. I know where the power levers are. I know how to finesse things through supplies, through word processing. I'm 50% more productive than I was. I'll split the difference with you. That is a much more likely approach, because people can hear the cash register ring when you talk about those things. Then I would go for a title, failing the money, because then I would do what we call a jump shift. I would move from this job to a higher job without. It's like in bridge when you it's a higher order to shift suits and raise the bidding. Well, so I try to move up one step at a different company if they weren't coming with more money. Let me tell you why I wrote the book. It is not that I think people are necessarily greedy. A year and a half ago, I met a woman in a supermarket in Evanston who was buying huge boxes of Wheaties. And it was 10:30 at night, and so I said to her, my goodness, it's before Christmas. Are you expecting a lot of grandchildren? She said, oh, no, I eat them. Well, to make a long story short, this lady had meat once a week. She was living on Social Security. She had worked 45 years for only five different companies, and she'd never vested in anybody's pension plan. The business of money is not what happens to you at 22. Because it's at 22, it's chic to live in a drafty apartment and decorate it with TWA posters. At 80, it's horrible. And what you make now and how hard you fight now determines how miserable or how okay you'll be at 80. And even if you don't jog and smoke, you are going to live into your old age.
What do you think you should look for in a retirement or pension plan at a place you're working for? Which ones do you think are worth investing in?
I think the IRA is a message to America. IRA, the whole business, you know, taxation and the tax policies in this country really don't have too much to do with raising money. They have a lot to do with social policy and social change. When the government passed the universal IRA, they were saying to you and me and everybody else under 40 out there in radio land, you are going to be responsible for your old age. Don't count on Social Security. That is why we are making this change. If you had to borrow the money or mug people in the park, but please not old ladies, if you have to do that, you got to put your money away every year because there's a reason that we're getting that tax break. As much of it as you can, it's very important. And company pension plans, unless up until the day you retire, can be changed. So there's no way of predicting at 35 what would be a good plan at 65.
So you don't think that a nice pension plan should be very strongly considered when you're looking for a job somewhere? It's like if that's one of the differences between two positions, it shouldn't really tip the scales,
Kennedy's
you don't think?
Law is get the money up front. Here's why. Only 13% of all the people right now working in the entire country will ever vest in a pension plan. If you changed, if the company goes out of business, if you had to move somewhere, and particularly women, because most of us are still in a position where if our husbands got different jobs, we would move. Or younger women who aren't married move around the country, you really don't have a very good chance of vesting. And maybe the government will address that issue with companies, and maybe not. But pensions are designed not to be portable. That's one of the things I keep telling people in the book. Get the money up front, invest it yourself, live below the limit of your lifestyle. If you are living at more than 85% of your income, you have no leverage at all. You are a total victim. If anything happens to your job, MasterCard and Visa will come out and repossess you. Never mind the stuff. Because you are caught in a thing in which you have no leverage. You can't bargain with anybody. You can never hold out for anything. You have to say, hey, boss, yes, sir. And how high, sir or ma'am? Because you have no leverage. And yet, when I talk about this, people don't care. A lot of them will go ahead and spend right up to the limits of their income on the theory they can always get a job. And they still can, but not as quickly. That's the only difference in a recession and ordinary times, is the time lag.
If you're just joining us, Marilyn Kennedy is my guest, and she's written a number of books. One is called Office Politics. Her new book is called Salary Strategies. Now, you suggest that if you're negotiating for salary, whether it's because you're looking for a job or trying to advance in your job, that you arm yourself with as much information as possible about what your position would get at a similar corporation,
right,
or similar place of employment. Well, how do you find that out? Can you go to a library and find that out?
You've got to ask. What companies do that puts them ahead of all of us in bargaining is that they exchange regularly whole computer printouts with their competitors, with other companies, of what every position is making and how much. You got to get that information. not by theft, by saying to someone you know who works for a competitor, David, if this is the kind of job I'm interested in, let me describe it for you. If you will find out what they pay somebody like that in your company, it may not be his job, and give me that information, when I get my research together, and I'm going to research 10, 12 companies, I will send you a Xerox copy of that information. And what you're doing is duplicating the company's research. But otherwise, you go in for a job interview, and the boss says, how much do you want? And you say, well, what I had in mind was X to Y. And the boss, as all bosses will, say, you insect what makes you think you're worth that kind of money. And you say, instead of dying on the spot, it isn't what I think. These are the facts. Let us put them out here on the table between us. These are the facts. I've done the research. This is the market value of the job in this market. In Philadelphia, this is what you have to pay to get these services. I want market for my work. It gets out of need. It gets out of greed. It takes it all off a personal level because money is the most intensely personal. It's much more personal than sex. It really is. You go to a party and you say, how's your sex life? People will answer. You say, how much money do you earn? They'll fall in the Ramaki getting away from you. And they will tell everybody they know. I mean, this will be on the front page of the bulletin.
The bulletin just went under. Oh, you should know that.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
The Inquirer.
Well, so say you don't have like privy to these printouts or anything. How uncouth is it to call up five people who you vaguely know who hold similar positions in different parts of the country and ask them how much they make?
There is nothing uncouth about it, particularly if you say, again, what I'm saying. I'm not asking you to do anything for me for nothing. I will tell you what I find. I'm upfronting the money for the telephone calls. I'm going to send you a copy. You do that, and you will have more friends crawl out of the woodwork than you ever knew would be possible.
Because they can use that information when it's their turn to negotiate.
Terry, there is not a human being living who does not believe in his or her soul that somebody in the next desk is getting more money than they are, who doesn't live with that fear night and day that they're being ripped off. Now, maybe they're making more, but think how much better they'd be if they knew it.
Okay, so say you've gotten this information. You have a range of how many, 5, 10?
Usually 3 to 5.
3 to 5, okay.
$1,000. And 10 people in your survey.
Ten people in the survey, okay.
Right.
Now it's time for you to figure out what your minimum and maximum are. How do you figure that out?
Okay. The rate of inflation in the last 3 years was 12, 14, and about 11%. If you did not get about a 20% raise a year, you have fallen significantly behind. You know, you get a raise once a year, prices are compounded daily. When you're in aisle 1 of the supermarket, aisle 3, they're changing the prices. So what you have to do is you have to add the inflation factor in there. See what market is, and then say, okay, can I afford to work for the low end of market? Or do I have to put myself somewhere in the middle?
Okay. Should you be willing to accept your minimum in the bracket? This is one thing I've never been sure of. Say you're looking for a job, and someone says, well, what's your minimum and what's your maximum? Well, it always seems odd, you know, to say, well, I wouldn't work for any more than this. Because if you have a maximum, right, that's basically what you're saying.
And they're really asking range.
Yeah, right. So how should you be willing to finally make a deal within that range?
You put as the minimum of the range that you give them what is probably the midpoint of what you would accept. Because if they say, really, and they convince you that they cannot come within, they can come within 500, but not on your minimum. If it was the midpoint of your personal range, you're still okay. But you shouldn't change jobs or think about changing jobs for less than a 20% increase. And the reason is the inflation factor.
Okay, well, say you figured in that you're, the minimum you're telling them is actually the middle of your range. So if you settle for less, you're really doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
Will you look to them like you're too willing to accept compromise and you know, willing to go beneath your own standards?
No. Here's the thing. 80% of the people who turn down the first offer get a second offer. This I got from personnel people by surveying them. In 1979, the 25 largest search firms, what happened was they had about 40% of the people made what are known as opportunity moves, which means that they moved for not more than 10% more than they're making right now. In 1981, we couldn't find anybody who had done it surveying the same 25 firms. And what it tells you is that people are more concerned about the impact of inflation and that companies know this. They know that they have to come up with a certain amount before they can possibly expect people to change.
So you're negotiating a job with me, right?
Right.
And I've said, well, this is my final offer. This is it. I just can't go any higher than this. The business isn't doing that well. Think it over. This is it. And say you really want this job that I'm offering you, and you're actually willing to take it for that price, but you really think you deserve more, you want more. You're not sure if you can get it or not. I've told you this is my final offer, and this
right.
is it. How do you interpret that, and how do you act?
I see that as a preemptive ploy. That's like saying take it or leave it. So what I say to you is, well, this is very important, but before I give you my response, there are a couple of other things that I want to talk to you about. And then I go back and I resell you, because you are not sold. You still want me, or you'd say, look, we just can't afford you. So what I want to do is I want to back up. The whole key in negotiation is we never run head-to-head with anybody. If you say to me, this is my final offer, take it or leave it, if I either take it or leave it, I'm accepting those dimensions. But I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say, well, that is very important, but there are a couple of other things we need to discuss before I either take it or leave it. And I bring the conversation back away from the brink. That's like pointing a gun at somebody. Don't point unless you intend to shoot. But I don't want you to do that. And it isn't that it has to be either or. It just got that way. And so I got to pull it back. The whole emphasis of the book, the whole emphasis for everybody in 1982 is you have to take control. You can't expect that the company is going to take care of you. These companies, you look around in the economy, most companies are having a heck of a time taking care of themselves. Each one of us has to protect our own interests.
Okay, one other thing. Is it ever a good idea to give your boss an ultimatum, give me this salary or I'm leaving?
Never.
Why?
Because then you are doing something that has nothing to do with money but's even more sensitive. That is, you are challenging the boss's power. You are saying that I am not your subordinate. I am not part of the pyramid that leads toward you. I am pulling away. It's like if a married woman goes home and says, I've had a better offer from somebody who'd like to marry me, match it or I'm leaving. I think that that would kind of do in the marriage. The fabric of trust is gone. Same is true in challenging anyone in a relationship. I would never do that.
Okay. Marilyn Kennedy is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, which is called Salary Strategies. If you have any questions about salary negotiations or any other aspect of office politics, we can take your phone calls now. Our number is 923-2774. Again, at area code 215, the number is 923-2774. Some more advice that you give is when in the middle of these salary negotiations to not panic if there's any silence.
Yes.
What?
Here's what happens.
It's hard to not panic in silence.
Oh, I know. Here's what happens. You prepared this wonderful case. You go in, you say to the boss, I've done all these things, blah, blah. How does 15% sound? Right, and the boss is hearing this all orally, is working through it more slowly than you are, and there's a 30-second pause. And instead of waiting, having the really just the common courtesy to let this person pull his mind together, you say, but of course, if 15% is too much, I'd be happy with 12. You're bidding against yourself. If you cannot grit your teeth, bite your fingernails, whatever you want to do, long enough to let somebody respond, you can't negotiate. And one of the things we make people do in programs is to wait it out, is to slow down the going back and forth. It's like tennis in slow motion.
What if you really need more time to think? You've been, you know, kind of made a few offers, and it's you weren't prepared for something in it. It's difficult for you to think on your feet in this nerve-wracking, tense, but very important and consequential situation, at what point can you say, well, I need to think about this?
Terry, we have been going through this, and I need to get some of my numbers together. Could we meet about this tomorrow morning?
With 10 o'clock? That's not a sign of weakness on your part if you say that?
This is a business-like arrangement, you and I. You are paying me a salary, and I am giving you my services. Therefore, it's very important that I should have a chance to present myself in the best possible light. And if you say to me, no, it's now or never, then I go through what I do with ordinary intimidation.
Okay. Our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. Our phones are open if you have any questions about salary strategies or office politics for my guest, Marilyn Motz Kennedy. Now, I know that a number of our listeners work at nonprofit organizations, and this salary level and the whole approach, I think, to salary negotiation is somewhat different in a small nonprofit than it is in a large profit-making corporation. What suggestions do you have for people who are negotiating at a nonprofit? Do you think the process is different there?
No, because I think there are profitable nonprofits and dying nonprofits and a whole bunch in between that are hanging in there. And it's up to you to show that what you do is helping them be a profitable, or should I say surplus-rich nonprofit. And I think you do have to do that, because otherwise there is a tendency in nonprofits for people to relax and think, I don't really have to earn the money here because they're paying me so little. And if I were running a nonprofit, I would make sure there was a differential between the average performer and the star, because otherwise the stars will die on you every time in a nonprofit, because they know that basically management doesn't want to deal with this issue, but they have to.
Okay, in a lot of nonprofits, you're expected to work for less, because after all, profits isn't the name of the game in it. You're working for perhaps some social ideal that everybody agrees with and is committed to within the organization. And you're also working really long hours because of this commitment. So how do you take that into account when you're going through salary negotiations?
One of the things you have to do is to play the devil's advocate here and talk about the emperor's new clothes.
The what?
The emperor's new clothes. Remember the old fairy tale about only the little kid said the emperor's naked? You have to say, yes, it is true that we're all here for an ideal, but we have to be able to do that better, and possibly to be more productive, we ought to think of money as an incentive. Or just ask a question. Are you saying then that there is no merit increase possible? In other words, that more productivity will not produce more money. You will not find anybody in a profit or a nonprofit willing to look you in the eye and say, watch my lips. There is no more money available no matter how much harder you work. You won't find that. That's too much against the myth structure.
Okay, let's take our first phone call. Our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215. My guest is Marilyn Motz Kennedy. Her new book is called Salary Strategies. She is also the author of Office Politics. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I have a question to Marilyn.
Sure.
Yeah. I took a job recently at a lower pay scale than what I was usually used to. It's sort of a job change. And the reason I took that is because of the job market. I became a little bit paranoid with the current market and so forth. And I wasn't sure if I could really get the salary I was used to anymore. I'd like to ask you, what would you recommend in order to get that back at my new job?
Here's the strategy. Number one, whatever job you are in, there is a trade or professional association that serves that area. You will immediately go to the public library, get the Gale's Guide to International Trade, Business, and Professional Associations, and find out which one it is, and make the Philadelphia connection. You will attend those meetings. You will tell everybody, of course, I'm always open to opportunities. Here's the kind of thing I do. You will build your contacts, and that is how you will get back to the higher salary. But only contacts can help you, because if you have to go through the personnel system, they're going to say, ah, but you took less money here, and they're going to try to intimidate you. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you've got to go through contacts and avoid the personnel department at all costs.
Mm-hmm. One more question, please. How do you compare your recommendations for the Philadelphia area compared to other areas? I know you've been around a bit.
To me, Philadelphia does not look as nearly as depressed as either Portland, Detroit, of course,
yeah,
St. Louis is not doing as well. Philadelphia is more diversified. I don't think that it's in as bad a shape as some of the other markets.
Same in the construction industry as well?
The construction area, as far as I can see, is just getting ready to turn around.
To become better looking, you mean?
Yes, to become better looking. Not because of interest, but because a lot of unions are going to lend pension fund money to construction companies.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing this in the Chicago area. That's where they're asking for construction financing. It's
kind
of like a circle.
Thanks so much for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 923-2774 is our phone number if you have any questions for Marilyn Kennedy. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to ask Mrs. Kennedy how long a book has been out.
It just came out about a month and a half ago.
Oh, okay. And my daughter is going to something very similar to this now out in Dayton, Ohio, and I'll get your book for her, but I was wondering how things look out in that area.
I think the Middle West is in pretty good shape, other than the Upper Middle West. Also, it's a situational crisis. If your daughter wants to be an auto worker, this is not a good time. But if she is going to be in any part of the service industry, which, by the way, 70% of the people in this country are service workers, that's not depressed.
Right. Well, she's going into more business management and marketing in that area.
These are boom times for marketing because no one can figure out how to do it.
Good. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our number is 923-2774. Have you been reading much about the Japanese corporate management techniques?
Yes.
What are your opinions?
Quality circles will have a very hard time here. For our listeners, a quality circle means that employees get together and they make suggestions to management with their foremen on how to, improve productivity and quality. The problem is our nature of our society is very, very individualistic. And when you say to these people, do this for the good of the company, their eyes glaze over. When you say altruism in America, people do not know how to spell that word. The companies that are using a variant on the Japanese technique, but with money incentives, are seeing people do a 180-degree turn, spin on a dime. But when they say, we'll give you a T-shirt, we'll give you a pen, we'll put your name on a plaque, the employees literally do not know what these people are saying. So I think that part. The other thing is guaranteeing job security in America, as far as I can see, is not a possibility.
Why not?
Because you are offering people something that they have already decided they don't want. My company does focus group research. And when we did this, we asked people under 35, between 25 and 40 really, what job security meant to them. They said, job security means that I will always be able to get a job. I am a paladin. I'm a fast gun for hire. I'm available to the highest bidder. Loyalty is not a word I can spell. I do not know what that means. What I'm interested in is basically being independent. What I value is my ability to get a job. So how can you sell people something they already decided they don't want to buy? Even the auto workers are getting a little frisky on this issue.
Okay, so what about transferring to a job because of job security? Do many people do that?
No, not unless. The people with the greatest security risk right now are men under 35 with unemployed wives and two children under 5, because those are the people it would be hardest to be flexible in that lifestyle.
Okay, let's go back to the phones, and our number is 923-2774. Hello, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I have a fellowship at a local university here and have been offered a position as a graduate student in a better university, which I very much would like to attend, but the fellowship is about 25% less. The currency of exchange in these kinds of things is not usually the fellowship, it's the quality of the institution, but I'm wondering if you think there's any way that I can negotiate that.
Yes. What I would do is go back to whoever has control. That would probably be, say, the dean of the department in the university where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what you think you can contribute to the department. Do not talk about what you need to attend. Say, these are my strengths, and I know you have people in these three areas, but I can really make a contribution over here.
Mm-hmm.
Then talk in terms of other kinds of compensation, not just fellowship, but maybe there's some courses to be taught. Maybe the dean needs an assistant. Something, but talk in those terms, because if you do not, the dean is going to see you as someone who just wants more money. And what you are doing really is selling. Mm-hmm. And you do have to sell. If they think you will buy prestige instead of money, you will be a skinny, starved person by the end of the first year.
Mm-hmm.
You got to convince them that this is not a possibility, but you do want to work something out with them.
Mm-hmm. So you think I should negotiate, but not necessarily upfront about saying that I want more money, but negotiating for extras?
Explain how much money you would need to live on in this place, mm-hmm. this new place where you would be going. Point out how much they have already anteed up and say, now, how can we work it out for the rest of this money?
Mm-hmm.
This is different than a job situation.
Yes, it is. The problem is that at both my current institution and where I would like to attend, there's a set rate that's constant, and all students in the department get the same amount. So that in some ways, if I go in, I'm asking to be treated specially and differently.
You got it. You got it. That's exactly what you're asking for and what you should be asking for.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they are cloning students in that department, they are all different. If the other students agree to be treated the same, this is not your problem. You do not represent them.
Mm-hmm.
You can ask to be treated differently, independent of what their policy has been in the past.
But isn't there ever a set of rules of the game that you're supposed to understand when you're entering a situation? Like the rules of the university game are, for instance, variant from the rules of the corporate game or the rules of the nonprofit arts organization game. Like every organization has its own rules. Isn't part of the scheme knowing the rules of the game you're in?
As long as you understand that the rules are negotiable. The bottom line is that everything is always negotiable. What is wrong with asking? You have not said to these people, you haven't offered ultimatums. You haven't said, hey, if you don't do it my way, I'm going to leave. But what is wrong with saying, well, now, I know that that has always been the way we've done it, but is it possible? Sometimes people don't even ask, and maybe nobody else has thought that anyone would want that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, good luck to you, and thanks a lot for your phone call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I'm very interested in what Marilyn Kennedy is talking about, and my question is about what she sees as prospects for PhDs in the humanities moving into the business world. And what one does is the first step, what one can expect at a first job.
First of all, there is no such thing as a standard cloned PhD in humanities. You need to say, what are my skills? And furthermore, what are my interests?
Uh-huh.
Let me tell you how to find your skills in 1 minute.
Uh-huh.
You sit down and you go over everything that you have done in the past. And you say, of these things, regardless of the fact that I can't think of how anyone could make a nickel doing them, what are the things I do best?
Right.
Then which of the things do I like? Then put those together and go out and do some research and say, where are people using those skills in the real world?
Uh-huh.
And that's how you do it. A PhD will be valuable to a company that manages PhDs or wants PhDs, but your skills can be valuable to a variety of employers. Don't think teaching. Don't think any of those things. Think, what do I really do and who would be interested in buying it?
Uh-huh. And do you think that, I think one of the big differences is going from an environment which is competitive but in a sneakier kind of way in academia to a much more highly competitive environment in business.
It's just the opposite. You
really?
Will find that I spent 10.5 years in a university.
Uh-huh.
That's how I could write a book called Office Politics.
Uh-huh. Right.
The academic environment is 20% more political, minimum, than any company I've ever been in, and I've spent the last 5 years in consulting.
Huh. Okay, thank you.
It will
very
be
much.
Restful for you in the business world. Very restful.
Right, I think so too. I do.
Well, good luck, and thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye bye. If you have a question, our number is 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I was curious to know whether, in the area of negotiations such as the unions did with Ford, where the workers had a pay cut imposed on them predicated on the fact that the company needed that in order to stay alive and make money. How do you is there a way to negotiate out of that?
Here's
the unions have actually negotiated for you.
Right. You as an individual in the union don't have a prayer because what the union is doing, the union is really caught between a rock and a hard place.
Right.
They have to
justify their existence.
Not only that, but they have forced you to pay for their negotiating the original money and then pay to give it back. This does not sit well with a great many union members. if an employer comes to you and says, hey, will you give back 10% to help keep this company alive, and you're a white-collar worker,
right,
you have to make a choice. But one of the questions to be asked at that point is, for how long? Because you notice that in every UAW settlement, there is a time limit.
Right, yeah, they're 18-month contracts.
Right, they didn't ever say, give it back forever, because you know that the UAW members would have slaughtered.
And you're considering that strictly in a temporary vein, and it's just a fact of life in a hard world that this is, we're going to have to bite the bullet for the next 18 months in order to stay in a job.
During the last recession, which was 74-75, my husband was asked to take a 10% cut across the boards in order to keep the company going.
Right.
And he did, and then they were acquired by another company. And what was interesting is that they gave back the 10% before they turned over the new salary schedule
really?
To the new company.
That's amazing. Was that part of the negotiations for acquisition?
Well, they didn't tell them the salary schedule when they were acquiring until they gave it back to all their employees who had helped them by giving that up for 6 months. And they said, hey, we made you a promise, and we kept it.
I think that ought to be publicized in the media, because in today's age, that's hardly credible or hardly believable.
Well, it really happened. I watched it.
That's great.
Well, thanks so much for your
phone call. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Well, I just got noticed today that our staff has been cut back, and I'm probably in the list to be transferred to another department. Now, my question is the following. Over the last 3.5 years, I work in the public sector in the city of Philadelphia. I have saved the city approximately $3.5 to $4 million in my work. Now, I would like to know, what do I do to switch into the private sector and use this to my advantage? And I have no idea what they're making out there with that kind of work, nor do I know what the job titles are called.
Two things. You have to define generically what it is you do. That is, not what the city of Philadelphia calls you,
right,
but you have to say, what are the skills I'm using? What tasks do I do? Then you have to find an industry, people who are doing the same thing, again, through the trade associations.
Mm-hmm.
From there, you can ask these people, what is the salary range for people doing this kind of job? Your salary in private industry will depend on the level of responsibility, and the $3.5-4 million savings should be a dynamite opener with any company, because right now the two things management is interested in is increased productivity per worker and cost cutting.
Well, that's exactly what I do. I mean, I don't know what it's called, but you just hit on the nail what I do. And I would think that in private industry there's some sort of bonuses. And I see in the city of Philadelphia, it's strictly civil service. There's no merit system. And
right.
I'm trying to just determine, do I use this to say, okay, I would like a bonus structure that if I save this amount, I get this, so forth and so on,
yes.
Or is it strictly salary?
No, I would go for a bonus thing. Also, why don't you look at some medium-sized consulting firms?
Mm-hmm.
Because what consulting firms do is go in and figure out how to save money, and they do pay their employees on a bonus plan.
Is this management consulting firms you're
yes,
referring to?
Yes.
Oh, great. You're a big help. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. What advice does Marilyn have for a 60-year-old man who has lost his job because of business problems? Is there any future in finding another job?
There sure is. Do you know that about 15% of my clients are over 70? The idea that somehow a person dies at 65 is too awful to contemplate. The companies that will think this 60-year-old man is the most marvelous thing that ever walked in the door are small companies that are being run by younger people. Because what these younger people need, they're full of ideas and vigor and everything, but they need a few steadying hands on the helm. Anytime you have a disadvantage, whether it is age, whether it is a lack of education, whether it is the woman returning to work who hasn't worked for money in 20 years, don't say, hey, I have these terrible handicaps. Say, who would think that was an advantage? Who would see that as a benefit? We see people advertising in the Chicago Tribune for, quote, mature, unquote, people. What are they saying? Here is a person who has been stung by some young person who worked for them who spent all the time from Wednesday to Friday worrying about Saturday night. To them, a 60-year-old is an untaxed bonus.
How is Philadelphia for this sort of job? Lots of
There's a lot of small businesses. You got to go out and look at the underbelly of the market. Forget all the companies you ever heard of and start as you drive down the street looking at all those signs of places you never heard of.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for your call.
Yes.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I have a question for Marilyn. I've been in management for the last 10 years, and last year I was asked to take a salary cut. This year, again, they're asking me to take another salary cut or infer that I go elsewhere. I wonder what recourse I have. I'm the only one that's taking cuts. Everybody else I have to keep at the same salary, or they wouldn't have anyone working there.
The management is trying to tell you that they do not want you.
No, I am management. The owners are. They're saying that they can't afford to pay my salary.
Okay, the owners are telling you they do not want you.
Yes.
If I were you, I would turn that around and find another job. I would not stay and fight that because there is no percentage in it. There really isn't. If you have really produced for them, there are other companies that will want you. And I wouldn't take another salary cut. I would get another job as quickly as I could.
And leave them mid-season?
Why not? What are they doing for you? They've asked you to work harder for less money. What do you owe them? Nothing.
Oh, just I have a loyalty to all the people that work for me, and the people who have worked for me for all these years have been very loyal to me, and I feel if I go off and leave them, they're going to be getting salary cuts also.
I have one thing to say to you. Go to your kitchen, get a glass of water, put your finger in the water and take it out. Then say, how long does the impression last? That is what loyalty is like. There can never be loyalty in a commercial transaction. There can be integrity. There can be a good day's work for an honest dollar. But loyalty is not part of the business equation. You are going to lose a great deal if you don't turn that around.
You know, I never thought of it that way.
Oh,
Thank you.
You sound like a talented woman. Go out and turn your talents to good account.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. Right now I work for a nonprofit organization, and I'm thinking about going into the profit world because of the way things are here. And when you go to the interview and they say, how much are you making, and you name your outrageously low salary in spite of whatever your responsibilities are, then they turn around and they feel that they can lower their range because of what you're making now.
Okay, you do it with me. Let's just role play this. You say to me, how much are you making?
How much are you making?
I'm making $13,000.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now make me an offer.
I'll pay you $13,500. I mean, you know, it wouldn't take much more.
Okay.
Any improvement, you think?
Now, here's my answer.
Mm-hmm.
The market for this job is $16,000 to $18,000. The reason that I'm leaving the nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
which I strongly believe that they are a worthwhile organization,
sure.
is that I, Marilyn Kennedy, can no longer afford to work for less than market.
Mm-hmm.
That is why I am leaving, and I cannot sell my talents for less than market. It is not a question of a cheap thrill, getting a few extra dollars here or there.
Right.
I must make market for my services.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason you must make market for your services is because you do not want to live on Cheerios at 80. Even though Consumers Report says they're the most nutritious cereal, you do not want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That is why you must have market.
Another problem with working in a nonprofit organization is so you wind up doing so much more than your title describes. Like my title is secretary, but I'm really involved with all kinds
right.
of academics, and all this experience is not from a school. I mean, there's no degree.
Okay, so that doesn't matter.
It's more a matter of aptitude, I see it as.
No, it's a matter of what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
On your resume, you don't just write secretary.
Right.
You describe what you did and what was the result.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you make that long and juicy. And that helps you get another
okay.
job.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks for your call and good luck.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Marilyn Kennedy is my guest. She's the author of Office Politics and of a new book called Salary Strategies. She also writes a column for Glamour magazine. How has daycare affected the ability of women to work, and how do you think daycare is being affected by the social and economic climate now?
One of the things that's happened is that daycare is replacing nannies and babysitters as the method of choice for a great many women. I have an 8-month-old baby, and she has been in daycare since she was 6 weeks. And my sister, who runs a daycare center here in Philadelphia called the Children's Garden, it's in Wayne, is the one who turned me around because I thought that the best thing for my baby would be, since I work full-time, to have her in a with a nanny. And one of the things is that we want children to be with other children. And the economic climate has made a tremendous demand for daycare. And one of the things women need to think about is, am I telling other people that daycare is important, or am I one of those people who keeps apologizing that I don't have this white aproned lap for little Poopsie to sit in? But it isn't good for little Poopsie. She needs daycare. It's very important.
Okay, we're running out of time, but what do you think are the crucial issues now that are affecting the job market for management people,
the most important issue,
service people?
The most important issue right now is fear. Unless you can tell yourself that you are, in fact, worth what you are being paid and more, you do not have a prayer. Because everybody, we're animals. Everybody can smell fear. The second thing is, do your homework. This is not a market for people who come in and say, well, I've had these titles and I've done all these things. There's no position power in 1982. The word is results. Every time I see that commercial on television for Rolaids, I think R-E-S-U-L-T-S, results. Don't tell me what you were called. Tell me what you did. The third thing is, you better keep your skills going. If you have been coasting because your company's doing okay, you're going to find out that that won't cut it. Companies are giving up across the board increases, and they're saying 50% of the raise pool for the top 10% of the performers. Hey, that's going to make a big difference.
Okay, I want to thank you for talking with us. It's been most interesting.